You look for commonalities in the style, in the orthography, that spelling, in the various lexicon, and you put all these features together and you look for consistent idiosyncratic features in spoken or written language.
When I testify as an expert witness, I told the prosecutors, stop, don't tell me about the case. I would like to not know anything about that.
You write a report and you tell the police, this is the guy. What happens?
Hello.
You can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and creator of Manhunt Unabomber. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor, creator of, well, stuff, but not Manhunt Unabomber, I'm sad to say.
Yeah. And with us today, we have a very special Manhunt Unabomber guest.
Not Sam Worthington, who portrayed me in Manhunt Unabomber.
Right.
This is the actual James R. Fitzgerald, Jim Fitz for short. Here, glad again to be with you guys.
Way better. That's way better than an actor. Jim, we have a celebrity. He's not an actor. He's a real life guy who did real life cool stuff.
Fitz was actually the guy who sat in the seat to my right, and I sat to his left in the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, day one, when we both raised our right hands and swore allegiance to the Constitution of the United States and became FBI agents.
And we got to New York City on the bank robbery squad. I was on the desk to your right. You were on the desk to my left. And we worked a bunch of cases together there, bank robberies and victimized kids and kidnappings, you name it.
And in fact, the last time I was interviewed on Best Case, Worst Case, I talked to them about none other than Paul Noring. It was our first arrest together. It was my first arrest ever. And it was a really cool case because we did what all these other senior agents hadn't done in 3 years. We did in a very short period of time. And that was pretty cool.
That is, we identified the guy and located him and arrested him all within about an hour and a half, I think.
Yeah. I know. And Jim, I had spent like a week compiling a list of potential companies to go visit. And the very first one, we drove up and there he was. It was great. And I remember, and I told everybody about how you pounded on the desk and said, you're lying to us. And I was like holding you back. And he said, what if I tell you what I know? And that was it. That was it.
That's when you can actually interview people and get your point across and get some answers from them. Probably those days are different now. We didn't touch him. I just banged on his desk. I don't think, do desks have civil rights? I'm not sure.
You never know now, Fitz, but I do have to say that our listeners, I titled that episode a couple of weeks ago as The Jims, because Jim said lots of people referred to you guys as The Jims. And so the title of the episode was The Jims. And we had some feedback on our Facebook page where people said, I'm so disappointed. I thought The Jims meant Fitz would be coming and would be on the podcast. And so, by popular demand, here you are.
Okay, Fitz, so let's dive right into this.
Glad to be back.
So, do you have a particular case you want to talk to us about?
Well, I do.
And where were you in your career? What point in your career did this case come to you?
I was about 9 years into retirement when this case came to me. I was a private citizen in United States of America, and I was contacted, and the case fell into my lap.
Jim, this might be a first. I think this is a first, a post-career case.
I think you might be absolutely right. And so, Fitz, what were you doing on the day this case unceremoniously fell into your lap?
I was looking over the Hudson River in a high-rise hotel building in Hackensack, New Jersey. I was there with my partner, Natalie. She had a conference, and I got some emails and wound up doing some texting back and forth. And here, all the way to Australia, I had a police officer in the Victoria PD who needed some help with a case involving anonymous letters.
Wow.
And I said, I'm a forensic linguist here in the U.S., and I would be, I've plied my trade in civil and criminal cases. But if you want to bring me on board, let's do it. Tell me what you got. Next thing you know, I was officially on the case, helping them out solve this case.
Wow.
Well, this is so interesting, Fitz, because we have lots of listeners in Australia. And in fact, I'm working on a project at XG Productions with an Australian showrunner. And so whenever we have our Zoom meetings, it has to be really late here in Atlanta and really early over there in Australia. That's the hardest thing I think about working with people in Australia is that time difference. It's like 14 hours or something.
Yeah, but wait, but is it early in the morning the next day or the previous day?
It's tomorrow. It's always tomorrow in Australia.
Here is how I figured it out. I was in Sydney, Australia in November of 2004. And I wanted to watch my Eagles play the Dallas Cowboys on Monday Night Football. So to this day, I always remember that game started for me 1 o'clock Tuesday afternoon. So whenever I want to figure out the time difference between the East Coast of the U.S. and Australia, this was Sydney, it's if it's 1 o'clock. So whatever it is now, it's three. I won't even try to do the math. But all I know is on a Tuesday at 1 in Sydney, it's 9 p.m. in Philadelphia.
On Monday.
And I can just hear our Sydney listeners, as I say it's always tomorrow in Australia, I guarantee you there's at least one saying, no, Francie, it's yesterday where That's you right. are.
That's right.
Right. Well, so when you were talking to somebody yesterday now in Australia, what did this person convey to you in your very first interaction?
Well, and I want to make sure this is clear. I'm actually going to present two cases and just talk briefly about the first one, because this first call I just told you about, this contact with the Victoria PD investigator, had to do with a number of anonymous letters being sent to a primary school in Victoria, as well as parents and teachers involved with it. And it so happens this particular case, a certain individual got a promotion. Some individuals did not. The police were pretty sure it was one of those who didn't get promoted. So they had me look at the writings of about 10 different people. I finally narrowed it down to one. And they said, well, that's pretty good. How do you do it? I said, forensic linguistics. I mean, I had the anonymous communications, about 25 of them. Actually, some more came in as I was working the case. And then we had about 20 to 25 emails, text messages, like principal reports, if you will, meaning the principal of a of this primary school. And I looked at them all together and said, it's this particular woman right here. It turns out, oh, well, she didn't get the promotion. People knew she was pretty upset. And they said, are you sure it's her? I said, yeah, forensic linguistics doesn't lie. And then don't you know it, a week later, they get one of the envelopes back from the lab. What do they find under the stamp? Her fingerprint.
For those of us, I mean, there probably aren't that many listeners that don't know. But for those of us who don't really understand forensic linguistics, can you tell us what that actually meant you did? I mean, you've said you had the anonymous letters and you had what I would call exemplars from the, quote, suspects. But what do you do exactly?
Sure. And anyone who's watched Manhunt Unabomber or read my books or anything like that, A Journey to the Center of the Mind, they know that linguistics, of course, is the scientific study of language. And forensics, of course, is arguing the law out of the Latin. And it all comes together with looking at documents and attempting to determine authorship of anonymous documents. And what, of course, you need, you can't control the number of anonymous question documents, exemplars, as you would call them. And I say documents, they can be emails, they can be blog postings, they can be, I've actually worked cases off the broadside of a barn. I mean that literally in my FBI days. A young girl, April Tinsley, Jim, remember that case?
Of course.
Out of the Midwest. And there was some writings on the side of a barn where the girl's a missing shoe or something like that. And the police finally put that all together.
Isn't there also a bicycle involved in that case?
A few years later, someone left DNA on the bike with a note, and it was the DNA that matched that found on the dead little girl. Eventually, that case was solved. So good news there. But the point is with this, what we call in linguistics in the subcategory would be authorial attribution analysis. And again, it's what I did in the Unabom case. You compare known writings, if you have a suspect, to the question communications. You may have one, you may have 14, like in the Unabom case, including a 35,000-word Q14, and you look for commonalities in the style, in the orthography, that spelling, in the various lexicon, and you put all these features together and you look for, I never say fingerprints or DNA-like material, but you look for consistent idiosyncratic features in spoken or written language, and a trained linguist knows what to look for, knows what's, you know, what's more common, what's not. In many cases, I compare them to a third corpus of writings, so I can kind of break down and sort of like, that's my control sample. So I know what's truly idiosyncratic. It's not just me saying this, but you go on this website or the internet or whatever, and you can say, look, this is so uncommon, only found in these documents, whatever. And this is completely evidentiary, and you two are both lawyers. There are some parts of profiling, as you know, that, you know, they're not admissible. The testimony would not be admissible in court, but this is, because it's not profiling. It's the science of linguistics and comparing written or spoken language features for comparison purposes. So It's I've testified a dozen times in the U.S. Unfortunately, I keep losing chances to testify because the people keep pleading. As soon as my report shows up, the defense wants to plead them out.
I have a question, Fitz. I have a question. Maybe this is a stupid question.
Well,
but
Francie.
Stop it. No.
Do we really have to even say that?
Yes, we do. Fitz, do you think your job was easier when most product was actually handwritten to compare? I mean, does it make any difference now? Or is that just not, am I just sort of missing the science of linguistics? It's not about how it's written. It's about what you're saying.
Well, Francie, I can even answer that question.
Stop it. I don't want you to answer.
You're talking about graphology, if I'm not mistaken, and not linguistic comparison.
No, I know that I'm not talking about literal handwriting analysis. I just mean sort of the style. It seems like there's just a lot more clues when you have a handwritten document than when you have a cold page of typeface.
Francie, that is a good question. It's not a stupid question.
Have you preempted
your question with that. Anyway.
Something in my throat here. I just couldn't.
It's funny, though, you asked that. So, no, a linguist can examine, and I've done this, handwritten, meaning actually block printing or cursive writing to an email, to a blog posting, to any genre, if you will, of writing, also to include spoken language. I've compared written language to spoken language. Of course, it's different genre. You're comparing, you're not looking at punctuation when someone speaks, since they actually put commas and periods or in their sentences or afterwards. So no, it doesn't really matter. I do feel bad. I've said this a few times. I think the people who were handwriting analysts, and we knew a few of them, Jim, back in the day, they're kind of out of business now. All they're asked to look at are maybe signatures on checks. And, you know, if you only have, you know, 15 or 20 letters between the first, middle, initial, and last name, there's not that much to go in there. But it's interesting, just in the last few weeks, I was contacted by someone who does like PI work, and she had a client, I won't go into any names, but he had a letter from a woman, and it was handwritten in cursive. And he wanted to know, with my forensic linguistic skills, could I look at the letter and determine personality issues and other factors that may be important in looking at something like this? I said to the person with whom I'm dealing, well, wait a minute. Does this guy know this woman? Oh, yeah. Has he known her for a while? Yeah. Well, why can't he ask her these questions? Why does he want me to look at this cursive written 3-page letter to determine some kind of personality traits that may be hidden to him on the surface? And so it's basically that graphology we were talking about. I said, no, I don't do that. It's not court accepted. Get someone else, but that's not me.
Right. And so, Francie, actually, yeah, I was just joking, but I know what you're talking about. Actually, when you're typing, it seems to me that maybe people adopt a more formal communication style. And when you're texting, it's actually a less formal communication style. So I think there could be some intrinsic differences based on how the communication is transmitted.
Yet still comparable. And there have been court cases in which texts were compared to handwritten, to documents, to email communications, you name it. It is language, and that is what's being measured. And yes, it's easier perhaps comparing text messages to text messages, but there are some features sometimes too. And of course, spell check comes in. How does that alter sort of the universe of forensic linguistic analysis? But it still works. It doesn't catch all the factors with someone, only writing in passive voice or dangling their participles or ending sentences with prepositions, using double semicolons, M dashes, N dashes, all those things, which ultimately can help determine who is the author of one or more question communications.
And while we're talking about this, Fitz, since you are the ultimate authority, at least in my life, about those things, those dot, dot, dots that I do like to use when I'm writing scripts, because they insert a pause so you can actually, digest the information that's just being conveyed before. And they could be dramatic pauses. But when you use them, those three dots, what are they called?
Points of ellipses.
Points of ellipses. Ooh, that's
ellipses is plural, ellipses singular. So
I think that's the title of the episode, Jim.
Points of ellipses. I think you're right.
Love it.
So when you use points of ellipses attached to the words at the end of a phrase, right? It doesn't have to be a full sentence. It could be a phrase, right? And then you skip a space. Do you start the next sentence with a capital?
Well, you're wrong from the get-go, Jim, from rules of grammar.
Wow. Wait a minute. I think we need to edit that part out. I'm sorry, I didn't catch that part.
That's a meaningless. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain or the man in front of the curtain. But all right, so go for it, James.
I am not a grammarian. All of a sudden, I'll look at an email from a month ago or a year ago.
A grammarian. Of course you're a grammarian if you know what the word grammarian means.
If you know the word grammarian, you are one.
All right. Well, I don't have that under my title, grammarian in chief or whatever. However, in American English, as opposed to British English, a points of ellipses is only supposed to be used inside a quotation. That's the only grammatical purpose as per definition that it's used for.
To indicate that they skipped something.
Missing words. Yes.
Okay.
But do we all use points of ellipses to end sentences, to end paragraphs? Yes. So you're in your own world once you decide to cross that Rubicon of non-grammatical usage of the points of ellipses.
I think grammarians are wrong because
Jim,
it
you've
is
had so many
way.
Rubicons in your life, let's be honest.
Yeah, but let's get serious. I mean, what's the best way to convey at the end of or in the middle of a dialogue when somebody wants to imply something heavily but not actually say it? It's points of ellipses. I think that's hands down the best way to do it.
I'm not going to argue with you. I'm just telling you what the grammarians say.
Who are these grammarians anyway?
Well, it's a guy named Philo up in Bayonne, New Jersey, who is the grammarian.
This has got to be the only podcast in existence where you can have these kinds of erudite discussions.
But the point is, all the stuff Jim's talking about solves cases. And if Jim was sending threatening communications to, I don't know, some...
Francie, no, I didn't do that. Why would anybody say that? Who would ever accuse me of something like that? None of my friends. If you ask my friends, none of them would ever say that I would be the type of person... I think those were non-denial denials, weren't they, Francie?
I think it was, Jim. Even I spotted that. And I'm not the profiler on the podcast.
No, I don't think you are. But anyway, that said, Fitz, weren't you telling us a story?
I think I was. I'll end this part of the conversation with one thing about you, Jim. You wouldn't send an anonymous communication to tell somebody off. You'd go right to their face and say, hey, listen, A.H., here's what I think, blah, blah. Maybe a little more diplomatic at first. But my point is, if you ever did go into a writing something, I would say, let me see some of the scripts he's wrote. Oh, here are these same points of ellipses at the end of a sentence. I'm going to come kill you, dot, dot, dot. I look at your script, and there is the same thing.
There you go. It would be a dead giveaway.
If I end up murdered, everyone looked to see if Jim had previously sent me something with points of ellipses at the end.
There you go. It's definitely true. I would give myself away that way. But why wouldn't I want to take credit for something like that? I don't know.
So you tell these Aussies that it is the probably disgruntled woman who has not gotten the promotion. What happens next?
Yeah, and this was, and they were very amazed at how this whole process, they got my report, 15, 18 pages, whatever it was. I think there were 25 Q docs. I think I had to look at about 50 K docs from text messages to official school reports when she was first at this school.
So Q docs are question docs that anonymous. You don't know the author of, and K docs are known documents that you know the author of. Just so our listeners know.
Yeah.
K, I mean.
K and Q, and it's not reversed in Australia, just for our listeners down there. Eastern or Southern Hemisphere. So all that being said, in this case, finally, I said, this is your author. And the school board was glad to hear this. She was fired from even because she never got the promotion to begin with. And she hired an and then next thing you know, she did a search warrant. She hired an attorney. And next thing you know, they're complaining in public. This FBI profiler from the U.S. said this about her and gave a profile. And I never did give a profile. I gave a forensic linguistic analysis in my report. Long story short, that eventually came to an end in November of 2019, and she pleaded guilty two nights before her trial was to start. So I wanted to lay that as the groundwork for kind of bigger case that another detective in the same Victoria PD heard of the work I did on this primary school case, and she said, I think we got to hire this Fitzgerald guy. Plus, I saw the miniseries, so he must be good.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
So, Jim, I just have to say, as unusual as it is that we have a prologue case to the case that you're talking about this week, it's not unexpected with you. I've read your books, and I would recommend them to anybody who's out there who's curious about not only Jim's life and career, but the creation of forensic linguistic profiling. But I will have to say this, Jim. There are a lot of words in them. Many, many words.
I've been told that
before. But they're all really great words.
Some people compliment me on that. A few people say, oh, too much. Other people say, you are such a detailed person. So probably what I just went through in the last 10 minutes had some details in there. You disrupted everything with your points of ellipsis story.
Well, it was an important point because you brought up those kinds of weird grammatical, grammarian issues.
So now, Fitz, you are tied in to the Victoria Police Department way over in Tomorrowland, literally.
Okay. Or yesterday land, depending on
whichever
point of view. So another detective contacts me by email and says, Jim, I understand the good work you're doing with my colleague. We have kind of a stalking case that's been going on about 5 years with several women being victims. Now it's one woman I'm working with. She's been victimized for 2 years. Do you think forensic linguistics could help? And people always ask me this question, maybe on the phone, maybe by email. I said, well, I don't know. But if, I can without seeing the evidence. But if you have one or more good suspects and you have enough Q documents, again, question anonymous communications, I can at least give it a look at and see what we can come up with. So next thing you know, I'm on board. They send me about 20 Q communications. And at this point, they had one strong suspect and I had some K documents from him and I got to work.
All right. And when you say you got to work, did you go to Australia or did you do this from the comfort of your own home?
Yeah, that's a good question. And early on, I wasn't sure how they wanted to do this for various reasons, mostly budgetary, of course. But they obviously had my CV. They recognized me as an expert in the U.S. And they talked to their prosecutor's office there. Maybe it's solicitor, or I get confused sometimes in British court systems, Australian court systems. But they said, yeah, fine, bring him on board. And the first thing I did was look at the 20 or so Q documents of this individual from my home office, and in, if not daily, weekly contact with the detective in Australia. And I had a few questions for her. But what I always try to do in these cases, Jim and Francie, is that I tell them up front, I don't want to know too much about the case itself, the facts of the case, even the victimology or the suspect information. I want to, if I'm going to testify in this case, I want to be up there as in sort of a sterilized environment, meaning my prior work environment, that I had no ideas where their fingerprints found, where their pictures of the guy putting the notes on the car door or, you know, whatever. I just want to look at the four corners of the documents they send me. So I've since learned information about this case, which I'll share with you guys. But the point is, looking at this case itself, all I knew is here is 20 or so question communications, really nasty ones, and I can share some of it with you down the line, and then the known writings of this same individual, and fortunately they were lengthy enough and had enough very distinctive material contained therein that I could say this is your guy, and they said give us a report, and that's what I was glad to do.
Great. Well, Fitz, I agree with you about the expert witness side of this because I think it's really important. Because it shuts down defense avenues of attacking you. And I did the same thing. And when I testified as an expert witness, I told the prosecutors, stop, don't tell me about the case. I'll tell you what areas I can testify about. And I will come in and I would like to testify first as an education witness, not about the facts of your particular case or this particular defendant. I would like to not know anything about that. And I would like to be able to just inform the jury so that when they do hear the evidence, they hear it with an educated ear and informed eye. So they hear and see the case with an educated ear and informed eye. So the fact that you did that right from the start, I think that enhances your credibility, I hope, with the investigators and with the prosecutor.
Yeah, Fitz, I mean, I'd like to know, I guess, can you give us a few examples? I mean, so the question documents were, what was this whole case about? You said stalking. So were these threatening communications? Can you sort of categorize those for us?
Yeah, not so much threatening as, what's the right word? Blaspheming, insulting, questioning morals and characters. And this guy was not only mailing them to people, putting them through the postal system, but he was actually hanging them up outside of bars, on telephone poles, utility poles, and they were very much, salacious type material. All lies, of course, about the victim. But at the same time, they were very much questioning her character, her morality, her sexual history, and he names her. You know, he names the person by name, and so it was very embarrassing to this woman. And she had a relationship with this guy for a few months. I'm not even sure exactly how long it lasted, but she definitely had a relationship with him, and she ended it. And it seems like she had some reason to end it, as I learned later. But she didn't go back and said, "Hey, that's it. It's over and done with." In the meantime, one of her friends died. It looks like she may have committed suicide, but she's wondering, did this guy, you know, even the notes, or because her name was mentioned in some of these letters, did somehow she overreact to these things and decide to take her own life as a result of that? So this really got really to the point that there was our victim was really scared for her own life. She had young children. She was either separated or divorced at the time. And it was a scary situation for a few years. And the police were doing their best, but their hands were kind of tied until this detective, and I'll mention her name, Rebecca Norris, a Victoria PD, senior constable detective, I think is the full title. She got on board and she really, she wanted to make this case for this woman, looking at all the probable cause, the evidence. And she figured at some time, at some point, she'd need a forensic linguist to get involved in the case. Her colleague at the PD had good success with me in the primary school case I referenced. And then, of course, she saw the miniseries about Unabom and forensic linguistics. She said, I think we should bring this guy on board. And that's when it started. And that's when I got into this case. And I was glad to be able to help them out.
Well, Fitz, that sort of brings me to my earlier question that Jim so insultingly noted was stupid.
But I think it was you, Francie, who I know, you're suggested right. that.
But it is kind of the same question.
Thank you for giving me credit for something.
Always, Jim, always. It's kind of the same question, though, Fitz. If you have these question documents that are kind of salacious or threatening, and you compare it with someone's sort of ordinary speech that they would engage in with a friend or their mother or their boss, it seems like there wouldn't be any commonalities between those two because they would be a completely different style. So how do you do that? I want you to show us how the sausage is made.
Well, and that's a good point you bring up in terms of the emotionality involved in most threatening communications or harassing communication. When someone sits down, either handwrite or sit at a computer board to put these words to paper, to screen, whatever, there usually is emotion involved, and they're fired up for whatever reason in their past, in their present, thinking about what could be in their future. But for some reason now, it's over and done with. I'm talking about in an interpersonal relation case. However, what is common is their usage of language. And as I testify to in front of judges and juries in the voir dire section of a trial, when my credentials and my credibility and my expertise is being established, and even in the trial itself in front of the triers of the facts, I say it's much easier for someone to try to disguise their writing than it is to hide lifelong linguistic habits, which we all have. There's a linguistic term, idiolect. I know I may have used this on some of the shows before, but it's everyone's it's a term for a personal dialect. We all have one. I've got Philadelphia in my speech patterns. Jim has New York. Francie, you're kind of Midwest, Southern type thing, but I tell you, you've probably changed. You can probably talk to some old girlfriend on the phone and it goes into a little different dialect features. And that's what happens. And certainly in written communications, you don't have pronunciations to judge, but you certainly have words and spellings and formatting. And this guy, quite frankly, some cases are more difficult than others. But this guy, there's a few ways he made it sort of easy for me as a forensic linguist with some of his ongoing habits that he just really couldn't seemingly avoid. They're just ingrained in his writing style.
Can you give us an example, or am I asking you too much, Fitz? Just tell me if you can't.
No, not at all. He, one of the most obvious examples is every paragraph was a single sentence. Okay, it's not wrong. Grammarians, who are those people again? But, you know, you're supposed to have more than one sentence to a paragraph. Journalists sometimes, they'll write either in a newspaper or their media site, maybe one sentence, at least at the beginning, to kind of attract the reader, get them into what the story is. This guy almost all the time wrote in one sentence. I actually did some statistical analyses of how many times in the Q docs he did this, how many times in the K docs. Then I looked at some other control samples of other writings not related at all to this case, and people writing in 2 sentence, 3 sentence, 10 sentence paragraphs. There's really no right and wrong about this. It's what's idiosyncratic and what's distinctive to the person involved.
And I can say, Jim, that I, whenever I'm writing any kind of document, I definitely try to avoid one sentence paragraphs, except for the closing. I will typically say, thank you for your time and consideration or something like that.
Of course.
And that's the only type of one sentence paragraph that I'll use. So I do think that's really interesting to see that is something that this guy seemed to do almost all the time.
And he did. And again, in both the Q and the K docs. And something else he did, which we may have learned when we were in school, he indented virtually every one sentence paragraph, and he indents them with different number of times hitting the space bar on many cases. There's not even a consistent indentation. And a lot of people aren't even taught to indent anymore when they learn.
Right, so that might give him his age away.
It also helped with the age factor there too. So yeah, that's something else we had. And I actually broke it down in my report to the percentage of times in the Q docs, percentage of times in the K docs, and they matched up within like 5 percentage points of each other each time.
Wow.
He never used the Oxford comma. And I'm not sure if you guys are Oxford comma users or not. It's also called the serial. There's serial killers, serial rapists, and serial commas, as I'm sure our listeners know. They're of different genre.
Jim, I've read your books. I'm pretty sure you use the Oxford comma.
I am an Oxford comma guy, and or serial comma. And yeah, it's a completely stylistic choice whether you want to put the comma in a list of words within a sentence before the conjunction or not. Some people do. Some people don't. This guy never used it.
And some people don't. In the remember Q-ducks. What any of that conjunction stuff is. But okay.
And or but or you know what conjunctions are. So this is how nerd I'm the first to acknowledge, you know, I'm the FBI profiler guy, forensic linguist, helped catch the Unabomber. But you sit around, I'm counting, you know, where commas are not sometimes, as opposed to where they are.
Fitz, I've got the title for your next book.
Okay.
Journey to the Center of the Mind. Instead of a new volume, it's Journey to the Center of the Mind, quote, language nerd.
Okay.
Can we?
And
colon language nerd. Anyway.
But I think we should dive into what is the Oxford comma. And
no, we should not.
We should, because it's actually when you're saying I went to the store, the mall, comma, and the park. That comma, most people don't use, but some people do use it. And
I do.
And Fitz found out that this guy does not use it. It's glaringly obvious to Fitz, because he knows how to use it, but most people these days just don't.
But just to be clear, it's not a right or wrong thing. If you don't use it, that's fine. The New York Times has a style guide, whatever.
Yeah. Oxford commaists or not.
I like Oxford commas. I also like the little hyphen to set off a an emphasis phrase. But anyway, Fitz, so you did all this comparison.
Well, that would be a dash. Just for you, for the record, that's a dash, not a hyphen.
What's a hyphen?
Hyphen separates a word. A dash separates a clause or a phrase. But don't worry about it.
He's killing me.
Don't
worry about
it. A hyphen is an interword device, whereas a dash is an intrasentence device.
Well, now I know. Sorry. Anyway, so Fitz, you're comparing all of these things.
I just learned
it
just now, too, by the way.
Yeah. Don't correct me anymore, Jim, when you know you don't know it either.
Yeah, but so, I'm just paraphrasing what Jim is teaching us.
It's very important.
You know, lowering it down to your level.
Stop it.
Thank you. Well, we have to go way lower than this to get down to my level of grammar. But so, Fitz, so you've got all of this comparison. You got the Q docs and the K docs, and you think it's the guy. So you write a report and you tell the police, this is the guy. What happens?
Well, first of all, and it's important that we linguists, and I do belong to the International Association of Forensic Linguists, and we came up with some guidelines over the years.
There's a what?
There's an International Association of Linguists?
Forensic linguists, not
forensic
just regular linguists.
Oh.
Forensic linguists.
IAFL.
Exactly. Wow. We're about 300 strong worldwide, and we have
and
conferences.
If you change letters around, it could spell fail.
Or, stop it. This is what I deal with every single week.
Leif would be a good one, but IAFL. Okay, we got that. Everybody join. Get your
only
doctorate
if they're forensic
in linguistics
linguists should they join.
And go join. That's a fun. It must be a fun organization to go to international conferences with, don't you think, Francie?
We're solving crimes.
Well, I think so. Frankly, to be honest, I'm actually fascinated by it. I'm fascinated by the discipline, and I say discipline very purposely because I would not have the discipline required for it the way that Fitz does. Because
so you're
I feel
a word
like
nerd,
you have the
Francie,
patience of Job.
Just admit it. You're a word nerd too.
The patience of Job, I should say. I am I'm a wannabe word nerd. But so Fitz, okay, so you write your report. Tell me
so
what happens.
So the language that is accepted throughout the world, in the world of forensic linguistics, we don't just say that guy did it, or we point to the defendant. Yeah, he's the writer. We're very careful. And we say that the writing style is, well, there's three choices. It's consistent, not consistent, or no decision. So if it is consistent, that means the writing styles match. Then within the consistent category, we have five distinctions therein. And they are exceptionally distinctive. That's like there is only the remotest of possibilities that this combination of features is shared by other writers. Then it goes down to highly distinctive, distinctive, moderately distinctive, and not distinctive. But even consistent with not distinctive, you're about the 50 percentile. It could be the person, it could not. But if you're up at exceptionally distinctive, which I said this is in this particular case, in the Victoria case of the stalker, you're in the high 90 percentile. We don't quantify it that way in court or in our report, but that is that's how we break it down. And I want to make it clear to you guys, as well as your listeners, that forensic linguists are very clear when doing authorial attribution analysis work that it's not like a fingerprint. It's not like a DNA. We can't say, to the exception of, you know, 7 billion other people, this person's the author of this particular text or communication. But we can really lay it out in front of a jury or a judge and say, here are the parameters I measured. Here they are in the K docs, the known docs. Here they are in the Q docs, the question docs. And here's even a third control sample. Look how rarely you find these features here, but they match up here. So that's what my report read. And I always put an emboldened paragraph on the first page so the client, the investigator, whoever can look at it. And I can just read this to you here. It's very short. As a result of a detailed forensic linguistic analysis, it is opined by James R. Fitzgerald Associates, my company, that the overall writing style of Max Gardner, that's the stalker's name, as reflected in his 7 known communications, is consistent to the degree of exceptionally distinctive, that's as high as it goes, to the writing style found in the 20 anonymous Q communications received by or referencing Diane McDonald. And she's our victim. And by the way, the ABC, Australian Broadcasting Company, has already interviewed her. Her name is out there. She's been in the media. She's writing her own book about this case. I'm very supportive of that. She's asked me if she can use my report in the case. So putting these names out, we're not going to be surprising anybody in this regard.
But I have a really important question. Did you use that ever elusive?
No.
Grammatical comma.
Oxford comma, Jim.
I know.
Oxford comma.
All right. Well, okay. Oxford comma in your summary of your report.
No, because there was no list.
Well, maybe you should have used one.
Thanks, Jim. Let me note that down for my next report.
Please. By using that, we will then be able to tell that it's from you, even if you don't sign the reports.
No, we wouldn't, because I use them too. Anyway, so Fitz, okay, so you've told them this, you've submitted the report, you've obviously communicated with the victim already because she's writing a book about her experience.
After the case, I contacted, or she contacted me, but never beforehand, just to be clear.
What I'd like to know is, how did the case sort of, the criminal part of the case end?
Well, of course, he had an attorney. I learned later he had stalked other women, but never arrested. And he was going to court. He was going to trial. He was innocent. He didn't do these documents. He even wrote one of these communications, which is one of my Q docs, to the prosecutor's office there, saying he didn't do this, he didn't do that. She said this, she said that. But I actually used that 7-page letter, I think, to actually help build my case and compare them, because he was highly emotional. It was clear when he wrote that particular communication. Now, I didn't put that in my report. I wouldn't testify to that, but it was certainly indicative to me from my experience that there was a lot of emotion in the Q docs and the K docs, because the other K docs that the victim turned over to us were, in fact, letters he wrote her. So you asked the earlier question about the level of emotionality, how they can be cross-compared. In this case, we had emotion all the way across. It wasn't just one of the K docs was to his insurance company disputing a bill or something, which that could still be valuable and the evidence would still be there conceivably. But here, everything was tied into this case in the 20 Q docs where he victimized the woman, Ms. McDonald, and also the 7 communications that he wrote to her, 6 of them, and 1 to the prosecutor's office.
So how did the criminal case turn out in Australia?
Yeah, so they're building up the trial, and it turns out I was online to, almost literally, I was going to testify in both of these cases about 3 nights apart. So I have to prep for one case because they're different. I mean, if it's Victoria PD, you know, it's authorial analysis, whatever, but 2 different cases. And you don't want to get them confused in your head because that can only be something the defense would jump on. So here, literally, I think it's the morning of, at least my time, I wake up an email, Jim, the school marm pleaded guilty. She admitted to writing all the letters and she'll be sentenced, you know, accordingly. Oh, okay. Well, that's good news. So it was supposed to be, though, me not traveling to Australia. It was going to be done by, I'm not sure, Zoom, Skype, or some program they had. And it would have been interesting. I've never testified, you know, online before or digitally, whatever you want to say it. So it would have been interesting. So, all right, that one's over. Now move on to the Max Gardner case. And of course, I was prepping for that, going back and forth with the investigator. And next thing you know, I think like 36 hours before that was going to go to trial, I wake up, there's an email, and Jim, he's pleaded guilty. He doesn't want to contest it anymore. So it wasn't about me. I mean, I can handle, you know, cross-examination. I'm not worried about that, but I'm really glad the victim didn't have to. And in really both cases, more sinister involvement in the second case with the stalker, but I'm really glad that she didn't have to go through that and be put through cross-examination and everything else. And you guys, as lawyers, you know how that goes. And you can handle someone very gently, but you can also handle them very harshly. And we see that more cases than not. So I'm glad both parties didn't have to testify. And the cases were adjudicated. The first person, I don't think, got any jail time. I think probation. This guy got 8 months. He got 8 months in prison. So not a whole lot for a stalker, but
it did not seem like enough to me.
Fitz. No, yeah. not at all. 8 months for being somebody who, you know, when they get out, he's not going to be a non-stalker. I mean, you know,
I wouldn't think.
It just seems like that is not.
Anymore because it's a pattern of behavior.
Yeah.
Not just with her, but with other victims before her, as I found out after the fact. So yeah, she is a bit concerned in our brief interchanges so far. She has some concern, and I think he may, with good behavior, get out in 6 months. So and that could just be a few months from the time of our interview today. So we'll see how that goes. But I'll certainly be so supportive as I can of her from, you know, whatever it is, the other side of the world, and do my best to help her through this case with her book, anything else she needs.
So, Fitz, ultimate question. Is this a best case or worst case for you in your post-law enforcement career?
It's definitely a best case. I really felt I helped out the authorities in two different cases, especially the second one involving the stalking victim. Victimization. So I was really glad to help out. It was good getting back. I don't mean good that I was happy someone's being violated or laws are being broken, but I mostly work civil matters now. And as you know, they can be kind of boring, important to the clients, but boring stuff. Well, here was an actual two criminal cases of harassment, threats, stalking, using the Australian mail. And if I had to put them in any category, it would definitely be best.
Awesome. Fitz, there's another case that you came out to L.A. and you were actually working on it in my sunroom. And that was an interesting case. Have you told us about that one yet?
I'm not sure if I summarized it. I don't think we did a whole episode, but
all right, well, next time I want to hear.
That was that a one. Criminal case, too. And that's
but it was right. Post. Was it? It was a post bureau case.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Post bureau. Yeah. So that was one of the few criminal cases. Yes.
Yeah. That, Francie, that'll be another.
Awesome. Always right. Happy to have Fitz on best case,
and
worst case.
I'll just leave this one clue. My report wound up having three people forced to leave the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of Louisiana. Yep.
This is something we have to have Fitz back for, Jim.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Fitz. It was great to have you.
Yeah, thanks, Fitz. And, you know, what's so cool is that like our professional careers, since we have been, you know, basically thrown together by circumstances at the FBI Academy and then in the New York office of the FBI and then at the Behavioral Analysis Unit of the FBI, we are now still thrown together both in XG Productions and a number of different things like Manhunt Unabomber. And again, it's always great to have you back on Best Case, Worst Case, because I know for a fact that you worked thousands of fascinating cases over the course of your long and storied career. So, well, we'll probably have to have you back at least 994 more times.
At least.
I'll be glad to talk about every serial murderer, serial killer, and serial comma.
All right. Awesome.
Nice.
Well, thank
Nicely
you.
Done.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Until next time, this is Best Case, Worst Case, signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba. And hosted by Wonder.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's d2l.org.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.